Welcome back, unfortunately, to the last in this episode, and Rita's in the middle of a new book, and I'm so grateful to have her again with us to cover her first book, The Entrepreneurial Mindset. Rita McGrath, you're very welcome back.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, and it's made me go back and revisit some of this thinking.
Maybe Rita will tell people about your new book. Can we maybe give them a little insight into what's coming?
Yeah, so the new book is really, how do you design an organization that can push decision rights as close to the edges as possible? I call it being permissionless. And the fascinating thing is, how do you do that in a way that's also human and allows people to fulfill their potential? If you look at the statistics about how disengaged much of the workforce is, there's just such a potential gap, right? And I would love to write a book which says, okay, we're in this world of transient competitive advantage. How do you design an organization that's able to cope with that?
Fantastic. I look forward to it. And I always learned that quote from you, Andy Grove, snow melts first from the edges. That came from you. And then I went down the rabbit hole of covering that book. Another book that I'd love to collaborate with you on the future and cover, may he rest in peace, Andy Grove.
Indeed.
So let's get into where we are now, because we're at the stage where Rita advises us to assess competitive response. So what you say here is, having thought through how those first few buyers will be, you must next decide how aggressively you are going to move. To make this decision, you need to get a sense of the competitive terrain. Unless you have overwhelmingly powerful sources of competitive insulation, such as patents in the pharmaceutical industry, the response you get will be shaped in part by the initial moves you make. So I have a little diagram here for those who are joining us on YouTube about these competitive responses. So I'd love you to take us through this, Rita.
So the question is, you need to think about, for possible competitors, you need to be thinking about, is the area that you're going into going to be an area which they have also got a strong dependence or commitment to? And that can be either not very much, or it could be, hey, this is the bulk of their revenue, this is the bulk of their earnings. And then, are they very capable? Do they have people, talent, money, brand that would make them be able to cut you off if you get too close to their core business? And so if you look at the different kinds of competitors, if they're not very committed, they may be very capable, but they're not very committed. We call them sleeping dogs, right? Should you prove that this is a really attractive space, they could wake up. And so you want to keep an eye on them. But for now, you don't really need to worry about them too much. If they're low commitment and low capability, well, those are less of a concern because they're highly unlikely to be able to effectively undercut you. Much more dangerous is the situation where they've got a really high corporate commitment to the area, and they've got a high capacity to respond. So if you think about something like Procter & Gamble in laundry detergent, right? If you go after them there, they're a very capable company. This is their bread and butter, among other things. So they're likely to mount a really, really aggressive response to any move that you might make. So you really want to be careful about how you navigate around them. And that's where later on in the chapter, I talk about guerrilla strategies. And if you're trying to get into that kind of space, that's probably a more suitable approach. And then if they got a commitment, but they're not very capable, those you can go head to head with in many cases, especially if you've got more built up capabilities than they do.
It teed us up beautifully for competitive moves that are available to us as well. And in the chapter there, you cover these. They're beautiful. I'd love to bring our audience through these. There's four: the onslaught, the guerrilla campaign, feints, and gambits. And maybe we'll take them one by one because you have great examples in there as well. So let's begin with onslaughts.
Well, an onslaught is, you know, a visible, forceful move into a specific arena. And if you're going to do an onslaught, you have to be pretty sure that you know what you're doing. So if you think about something like, a more recent example would be WeWork going into the sort of commercial leasing space. Now, they had the virtue of having virtually unlimited funds to do this. But what they did was they went very aggressively into spaces that had previously been occupied by other, you know, short-term office rental companies. But they went in really big. They took out a ton of space. They built a big brand. They invested all kinds of money in advertising. And I would argue they did that, as we have now come to see, in a way that didn't make any economic sense. But that's an example of an onslaught, even full force entry into a particular space.
And next up, we have guerrilla campaigns. And you begin this by saying the objective of a guerrilla campaign is to build your position by moving into an arena piecemeal, starting in one niche and then progressively expanding into other niches as your position consolidates, something that you recommend highly.
Mm-hmm. I do. For a startup, especially, if you're resource constrained, this is unlikely to cause massive competitive retaliation in the beginning. Now, guerrilla campaigns are really interesting. And the original philosophy was codified actually by a book by Mao Zedong in a book he wrote. And he talked about the principles of guerrilla campaigns. So maybe I'll take you through that and then we can apply it to business. So in a guerrilla campaign, your goal is to use your enemy's resources against them. And typically is done by people who are in place, they're insurgents, or they're located in the area, and the attacker is often from somewhere else and may have many more resources, but they have to use a lot more of those resources to stay in place, right? And if you think about most successful revolutions or most successful insurgent campaigns, if you look at, you know, the Vietnamese versus the U.S., for example, Vietnam, a country which was very, very poor, basically saw off the richest nation in the world by waging one of these guerrilla campaigns. So the secret of it is you find locations with plentiful resources that are also very hard to reach. So swamps, there's lots of reptiles there, there's lots of fish, there's things you can eat. You can stow resources in caves, for example. So you want someplace where your troops can come back to, where your fighters can come back to, where they can get nourishment, they can rest. And so your combat is not face-to-face head-on the way it would be in an onslaught. Your combat is small raids, which are meant to capture bits and pieces of territory at a time, but you can always retreat if you need to. And the idea is you use asymmetric competitions. As Mao would say, we may lose one man, but if it costs 1,000 of the enemy, that's worth it. So you're using the asymmetry of your resources to succeed. And one of his core principles was you also have to have the support of the population. So you don't steal people's food, you don't invade their homes. You want to build this support in addition to your fighters, you want to build this sort of social support. So how does all that translate into business? And my co-author used to use the example of a travel business that he and his brother-in-law started. And in the travel business back in the day, there were the big players, the sort of massive American Express and people like that. And they would organize these group tours. And the tours would be standardized, right? And so what he and his brother-in-law did was they went along on one of these tours. And what they found was there was this population of people who were systematically being ignored by the established tour companies. And these were little old ladies, they came to call them. And so the little old ladies, they'd be struggling to keep up. They'd be ignored by the tour guides. They'd need to go to the bathroom and nobody allowed them. And so what they created was this travel company that just went after that segment. So in effect, what they were doing was they were using that as their niche to grow the business. Now, the big tour companies could care less, right? It wasn't really visible. They barely noticed that they lost that business. And so the idea was this, so it's a protected niche. They developed really good skills at serving that niche. So that's the equivalent of your guerrilla base, right? And these little ladies, by the way, a lot of them were widows. They had inherited all this money. So they were very wealthy, but they had completely different needs than the mainstream travel businesses. And the next business they got into was what they called the wild and crazy guys business, which was people who wanted to go on adventure tours with the real possibility of doing themselves grievous bodily harm. They're the kind of guys who want to like put their wrist up on the bar and say, well, I was in fighting a bull last week in Spain, and they'd show them the scar, you know, and everything. And again, the mainstream tour companies would never cater to these people. They'd be too worried about getting sued or whatever. So what they did was they grew their travel business by finding these little niches of people who wanted experiences, but who weren't fitting the mainstream mold of what a tour company would offer. So that's an example of a guerrilla campaign. You're finding, typically it's a niche. Typically you're serving that niche in a way that it would be very hard for an incumbent competitor to match. And you're growing that niche in a way that they don't even notice. So you don't really get that much competitive response when you're running a guerrilla campaign. And it's a great strategy to use if you're an entrepreneur or a new entrant that doesn't have a lot of resources.
Brilliant. And speaking of guerrillas, I told you before I used to play rugby. And many of my colleagues look like, maybe still look like guerrillas. But it reminded me of the next one. The next one is feints or what we used to call it in rugby was a dummy pass. So you're trying to make somebody buy the dummy, and this can be an advantage if you use it correctly.
Yeah, what you're doing with a feint is you're trying to fool your competitor into thinking that you're going to take an action which you actually have no intention of taking. So an example from my past was years ago, I was doing some work with BOC, the British Oxygen Company, and they and one of their key competitors, Air Liquide in France, had come to something of an understanding. So BOC was going to do, you know, Britain and sort of North America and South America, and Air Liquide was going to do Europe and Asia. And over many, this wasn't a verbal thing, but over many competitive interactions, it settled into these sort of zones of mutual ownership. And then Air Liquide started messing around in Latin America, which was like, whoa, you're in a space now where we thought we weren't going to bump up against you. And so BOC, which had pulled out of Europe, all of Europe for some time, what they did was they took out a bunch of billboards and newspaper ads, and they said, hey, you're now going to have more choice in your gas providers, and they would run it through where the major customers were. And then they took a couple of trucks with BOC branding on the back and just rode them up and down Europe. Well, Air Liquide completely freaked out. They pulled out all their people from Latin America, reinforced their relationships with all their customers, went running from customer to customer to make sure they get price concessions, and has BOC been visiting you? And it just caused enormous strain on their resources, and BOC had no intention of doing anything in Europe. So that's an example of a feint.
There's great examples in the book. There's an example in there of a candy manufacturer and how, again, used feinting to great effect as well. We won't go into that because there's so much more to share in this as well. The last one then I mentioned earlier on is the idea of a gambit, a term taken from chess.
So a gambit is what you do when you strategically decide to give your competitor something. You give them a market, or you give them an opportunity, or you give them a customer in order to accomplish a couple of things. It could be a signal, like, okay, I'm not as committed to this area as you might be, so I'll let you play there. It could be a declaration of intent. It's, okay, you want to do little old ladies? I want to do wild and crazy guys. You know, we'll each pick up our swim lane. So a gambit is also useful when you're getting stronger signals from one part of your addressable market than another, and you've decided you're just stretched too thin, so you can give your competitor something, conserve your resources, and then pursue the end game that you really want to pursue.
There's also then, at the end of that chapter, you mentioned combinations. So this is using different stratagems like onslaught, feint, and gambit together, for example, and you raise to the memory the great battle between Philip Morris and Marlborough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was called Marlborough Friday. And what had happened over many years was cigarette smoking in the United States had been a growing market, a very profitable growing market. But with the advent of public health campaigns and just general awareness of the dangers of smoking, the demand had been sort of inexorably coming down. And one of the dominant players in that was Philip Morris with their Marlborough brand. And one of the things that they decided to do was on a day famously called Marlborough Friday, they decided to slash the prices of their cigarettes. And then obviously this caused huge consternation. Competitors had to respond. And so what happened in the US was all the competitors now were put on notice that they had to cut their prices as well. So they slashed their prices. Everybody went down to the same level. And that basically wiped out resources from Marlboro's competitors. It caused a lot of cash to drain out of their profits. Now, meanwhile, what Philip Morris did was they were signaling this original domestic market that they'd grown up in was going to become a much less attractive market. It was going to shrink. It was going to be a smaller market. Meanwhile, when everybody else was, you know, rocking, trying to replace these lost revenues, they went and built something like 8 cigarette manufacturing plants in places where demand was going up. So places like Indonesia and Eastern Europe. And so they simultaneously took resources out of their competitors' pockets and then used the resources they had to build up in other places.
I'm going to move to skip discovery-driven planning, which is a chapter in the book, because hopefully, as I said, we'll cover that in future, and move to what you call the most important job, the job of entrepreneurial leadership. And I thought we'd start with the messages from leadership, because despite all the talk about innovation and the need for innovation with inside organizations, many leaders are tethered to the present, which are decisions made in the past. And you say a powerful symbolic and practical lever for communicating the importance you attach to new business development is how you manage your own agenda. I'd love if you share this. This is something that constantly comes up with corporate innovators, corporate entrepreneurs, corporate explorers.
Oh, it does. So this is also a question I get asked all the time, which is, okay, I'm a leader. I want to get started. Where do I begin with this whole process of innovation? And I would argue that this is easy and this is not expensive. It's how you manage your own time. So what I talk about is look at the agendas of your senior team. So a lot of times I get called into companies to chat about innovation or whatever. And I'll, in preparation for my first meeting, I'll say, okay, send me the agendas for the last few times your senior people got together to talk about important stuff. And they'll send it, right? And I'll go through it. And very often what you'll find is that innovation is item number 13, right next to material safety data sheet update or something. And what that means is that they're not paying attention. It's not important. So your own agenda, right? It needs to be item 1, 2, or 3, the same way it would be if it was anything else that you attached great importance to. Now, what that means is a sacrifice. Something else is going to have to get booted out of those 1, 2, or 3 places. So that's agenda. Second is how you spend your time. And what I find in companies that where the leadership is not really committed to innovation, it's nearly impossible to get their time. They'll say, oh yeah, I'll get to it. And then a month goes by and then 2 months go by and then you still haven't gotten the meeting and nothing really gets started because they're just not prioritizing it. Companies that really care about innovation, you'll see meetings that have nothing to do with the day-to-day. You'll have meetings that are either brainstorming meetings or regular product review meetings. So a couple of examples that are current. At the SAS Institute, their founder and CEO, Phil Goodnight, every Tuesday afternoon, his entire senior team would devote anywhere from 2 to 4 hours. Every Tuesday, 2 to 4 hours, on doing nothing but looking at the innovation pipeline. What are we working on? What's its health? What do we need to understand better? Where are we stuck? Every week. And all the people in the company knew that was happening. And so everybody knows it's literally on the agenda. And if you're going to devote that kind of time as a senior team to building this, that's really important. Second interesting example is Satya Nadella at Microsoft has senior team meetings with his leaders. And they'll take 20 to 40 minutes at each of their weekly meetings. And they'll beam in a Microsoft team that's working somewhere in the world on something that's new. And that team, they might have 2 or 3 teams that present, and they get an opportunity to say, here's what we're working on, here's the market for it, here's the progress that we've made, here's what we've learned. And so it's just a way of building for that connection to the edges we were talking about earlier, but also it makes it clear to everybody that there's a space here for thinking about what's new, and we're spending our time on it. So manage your agenda, manage your time. And then there's the small symbolic things. So if I run into you in the hallway, right? And you've been talking about innovation in the speeches, but in the hallway you say, hey, how's the quarter shaping up? Well, I know what you care about. If instead you say, oh, I'd love to hear more about that robotic project you were working on, right? Small nudges like that amplify at a senior level, and that gets the message out to the organization.
Oh man, I'd say so many of our listeners are kind of going, I wish I got that. I wish I got that question rather than the question, when will this be profitable, which happens so often. You say here as well, the problem with launching new business models is that everything about a new business model is likely to be out of whack with the business model of your existing core business. The more the new business opportunities differ from the model in your base business, the more difficult it will be for people used to the existing model to understand them. Unless and only unless you pay attention to resolving the discontinuities between the new models and the base business, the very forces that made the old business successful will tend to preserve it to the detriment of the business models you are creating. I love that. And here you raise another question, which I was funnily talking at an event last night, and I got this question from somebody who was in charge of a burgeoning new business model with inside the organization. And he said, I'm trying to get the organization to put our best people on this opportunity, because we've done all the research that it's a huge opportunity, but I can't get those resources over. And it's something that you recognized in this book as well. You said a vital ingredient for the success of your new business development program is that your very best people not only are put on those new initiatives, but they want to, because so many times people are put on these new ideas and they go, what did I do wrong? I'd love you to share your experience and maybe some good examples of this.
Yeah, well, it was, I think it was Peter Drucker and then Lou Gerstner echoed him many years later, saying that exceptional organizations put their best people on opportunities and typical organizations put their best people on problems. So I had a gent in one of my Columbia executive education courses just recently, and he runs a travel business, ironically. And we were talking about this in class, and he said, I just realized I'm making a huge mistake. I said, what is it? And he said, well, one of my bigger businesses has been really struggling. It's gone into decline, and I've taken all my top talent and put it on that. And so what I should be doing is maybe taking that talent and putting them on businesses that have a bigger potential for growth. But he hadn't seen that pattern until we raised it in class. So I think the trick is a couple of things. You want to, you almost want it to be a gating factor that you have to have participated in a growth business in order to be elevated to the most senior levels in a company. In some way. It doesn't mean necessarily that you have to run it, but you have to have enough familiarity that it doesn't feel like foreign territory. So you want it to be a net boost to your career. So you want the kind of conversations in your firm where people say, ooh, you got put on the emerging business opportunity program. That's really exciting. Rather than, oh, gee, you heard what happened to Don. You got put on emerging business opportunities. Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. It's human engineering, right? But unfortunately, people get very wrapped up in the day-to-day performance, and they think running a big business is the way to nirvana. The other thing that I think most companies get wrong is the proportionality. A little business that has the potential to grow needs disproportionate resources. It's like, think of it like a toddler, right? We all know a toddler or a baby's head is much, much bigger relative to the rest of its body than a grown-up's would be. And that's as it should be. There's a lot more brain to be looked after there. And that's the same with a fledgling business. It needs more talent, not less. It needs more attention, disproportionately, not less. So if you try to force fit it into the standard model of your base business, it's not going to be fit for purpose.
Beautiful. Great analogies. And the book is full of great analogies, great metaphors as well. Moving on to another one, great one here. So we're still on this idea of entrepreneurial leadership. So what did the leadership team do? And Rita introduces a whole slew of what she calls orchestrating practices. And you say here, Rita, people find uncertainty much more manageable if it can be framed, better understood, and simplified. And one of the challenges for an entrepreneurial leader is to help associates cope with the difficulty of determining what to focus on and how their priorities should be set. And this is where you introduce a great term. I was telling you, I heard of this through a recent series on the Corporate Explorer called Hunting Zones, but you called it ballparking, which I absolutely love this metaphor.
Yeah, what that does is it helps people understand what's in scope and out of scope. And so establishing a ballpark is just laying out, you know, what's the arena we're going after, what kinds of customers, with what approaches. And underneath all that is the conviction about why we should be able to win. And this came out of some work we did for many years at DuPont, and they were struggling with a lot of their innovations. And what we realized was that one of the gaps which happened came because the innovative teams would bring something to the leaders of an established business unit, and the established business unit wouldn't know what to do with them. So as an example, their model over the years had really shifted. So DuPont used to get paid for the stuff that they make. So typically it was patented, very high tech materials, basically. And as a way of selling those materials, they developed all this bespoke knowledge about how the material worked and how you could use it and what quality it was and all this stuff. And what started to happen was the materials, as globalization moved forward and patents expired and so forth, the materials part of it was getting commoditized, but the knowledge part was increasingly valuable, how you actually use the materials and put them into practice. And so their CEO developed this theory of, let's get paid for what we know. Now, back to business models, right? If I'm selling, one of the guys told me, he said, I make my money selling thousands of pounds of stuff. Well, if that's your model, and somebody says to you, well, sell thousands of dollars worth of minutes of really highly developed consulting services, it's a totally different business model. So what we realized was we had to get the senior teams of these business units to really embrace that before they would actually accept consulting slash services model into their materials businesses. So that was one example.
You have a great exercise in the book as well. And what I found so interesting about this is that, you know, when you do a workshop and you might say to an organization a pre-mortem, and you might go, tell us all the reasons that you will fail. And the boards are filled with reasons because of our negativity bias, versus you go, tell us how we'll save the business. And I thought what you said here is brilliant. You say oftentimes because of that negative bias that you can, if people are struggling to know where, what ballparks to play in, you can actually ask them the flip question, which is, where do you definitely not want to play in as well? So you can start with the negative, and maybe you'll share this exercise. This is the start, one half of the exercise.
One way of attacking that is I get people to think about where, if I go back in history and look at some things we did, some moves we made that we were really delighted by, and then some moves that, with the wisdom of hindsight, there's no way we would have ever embarked on them. And then what are the differences? And then you can begin to flesh out a rubric for what would make something more attractive versus less. And it's a great workshop exercise to do.
So you gave the examples of AT&T that were all over the shop, yeah, at Citibank, the Five Eyes.
Yeah, that was Walter Wriston's innovation. So at the time, Citibank was an international institutional bank, basically. And Wriston passionately believed that there was a huge opportunity in the opening up of credit and other kinds of services for individuals. And so when he became CEO, he designed this ballpark, which he called the Five Eyes. So the first eye was international. That was no Citibank had done that forever. And so that was not controversial. And the second eye was institutional. And again, that was where they came from. So that wasn't a big deal. The third eye, if I'm remembering, was individual. And that was a bit of a stretch, getting us into new areas. The fourth eye was information, so information-based products such as automatic teller machines and telephone banking and various kinds of, I was involved with a cash management product at the time that they made. And then the last eye, which never went anywhere under Wriston, proved to be a disaster later on when Citi tried to get into it, was insurance. But it was at least clear what they were doing. And if you asked anybody at the time in the bank where they were working on, they could link it to one of those eyes. So it became very clearly communicated.
Let's move on to a final part, which is hands-on leadership practices. You say here the final set of leadership practices to discuss are those in which you as the leader actively champion initiatives. As a leader, when you do become actively involved in identifying and developing new ventures, you personally can have enormous impact inside an organization. If you're a leader out there listening here, one of the most frustrating things is when you a workshop or a new product development project is organized, your head of learning and development or your strategy team hires in a great strategist like Rita, for example, and then you don't show up. So, because it sends such a message to the rest of the organization as well. So that's something that Rita alluded to earlier. And where's your diary? Where's your agenda? But one of the great practices you talk about is path clearing.
Yeah, well, that refers to the practice of how do you figure out who in the ecosystem, in the company, among your suppliers, who needs to be aligned with the objectives of this venture. So one of the stories that came out of the book is we were commissioned by Citibank back in the day to do a very thorough study of their internal corporate venturing program. So the gent that championed this felt that they were doing a lot of innovation, but they didn't really have a clearly thought through set of principles about how this should be done. So he commissioned us to do a three-year study of 33 corporate ventures, both successful ones and failed ones, and then to draw some conclusions. And so we did hundreds of interviews, and we did really in-depth document reviews and everything. And one of the ventures we examined was actually a brilliant concept, years, decades ahead of its time. It was called the Point of Sale Venture. And here was the idea that Citigroup would partner with a local shop, a grocery store, let's say, and give them a loyalty card. And the grocery shop would get a small percentage of what went on the loyalty card. But what Citigroup would get was a record of what these customers would buy who received the loyalty card. So it was called Point of Sale because the cards would be installed at the point of purchase or the point of sale. And the idea would be that then, like, if I knew that you were buying kitty litter, for example, either you got a terrible problem with your car or you got a cat. So now that I know you got a cat, I could cross market other products to you. And so it was an information-based business, sort of fell under the eyes of Ristin's rubric. And the concept, if you think about it, if you think about how marketing is done today, it was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And the intended customers were the big consumer product packaged goods companies. So Procter & Gamble and Unilever and all those guys. And the concept was that by selling them this information about what individual consumers were purchasing, they could cut back on their promotion budgets. Because at the time, the way that you got to customers, we did television advertising, you did flyers in magazines or newspapers that would be distributed, you did a lot of promotion of the product, and that you could cut back on that because now you knew with much greater precision who the target customer was likely to be. And there were two basic flaws that caused the business ultimately to fail. The first was just a strategic design. They didn't think it all the way through to what would make a business profitable, what would make that an appealing sale to a CPG company. And so what they would do, they did a national launch. So they got maybe 20-25% of each key market. We'll call it, they started in the United States, so each key market in the US. Now, the trouble is if I'm Procter & Gamble, right, and you've only got 25% of the addressable population, you're not saving me any money on promotion. I need to have 100% of all of Des Moines, right, before I can relax about my promotions of my products in Des Moines. So that was the first problem. They went too big, too national. And what they should have done was much more of a guerrilla approach, which they should have taken one town, one country, one area, and saturated that, and then moved to the next and the next and the next. And as we know now, this is incredibly valuable information, which they were brilliant at. But the second big mistake, in my view, was they never talked to the leadership at Citibank to sit down nose to nose with the leadership of Procter & Gamble and Unilever and all those companies and say, hey, we're in this business, we're committed to it. And instead, the reaction on the part of the customers was basically, let me tell you what's going to happen. You're going to dink around with this business for 2 or 3 years. You're going to spend an enormous amount of your money and my people's time on this. And then after 3 or 4 years, you're a bank. Right? You're not in the information business. You're not in consumer product goods. You're going to have a reversal somewhere in Venezuela or something. And then all of a sudden, you're going to decide to shut this thing down and you're going to leave us holding the bag. So I'm not interested. And so somebody like Ristin would have had to clear that path, would have had to say, no, look, we're going to partner. We're committed to this. And if we do end up for some reason shutting down the business, here's how we'll make you whole. In other words, taking that risk off the back of the potential customer. And that never happened. So they really never made any headway. And eventually the cash burn got so great that they did shut it down.
It's so true, isn't it? That I was talking to an entrepreneur about this recently. He said, ask for forgiveness, not for permission. It doesn't actually work. If you do that, you alienate the rest of the organization. You need them close. You need people like risk in the room, compliance in the room, regulation in the room. You need those guys on board. Otherwise, you could go and build this thing and then go, ta-da, and nobody wants it.
Yeah, that's a very common problem. I think what people don't understand is that there is a period of time in the life of a venture where you do experiment and you do have a lot of failures. You iterate your way to finding out what works. But when you want to accelerate, when you want to become a card-carrying member of the corporate world, the core business, you need to grow up, right? You need to pay off technical debt. You need to pay off operations debt. You need to pay off organizational debt. People have to go from having titles like world's most devastating ninja to vice president of engineering. And legal and compliance and all that stuff comes with it. Now, I'm not saying you have to be beholden to hidebound bureaucracy. There's smart ways of doing this and not, but you have to have the infrastructure to be a card-carrying member of the core business.
You mentioned there failure, for example, Rita, and I'm going to try and tie two of the threads together that we've discussed. So you say, underwriting entrepreneurial ventures often labor under a significant problem, skeptical potential customers and suppliers. Their attitude is likely to be, why should we support a venture that's still not viable and might get shut down? So that's from the customer side, but there's also then the hypos that have been put on that project. They're kind of going, if this fails, does that mean my record's tarnished?
Well, that's a huge issue, right? And I think most companies, even today, get this wrong. And so, ventures, and we're seeing this right now, this is going on even as we speak. People involved in something that's less certain or less guaranteed to have a return in a certain amount of time are much more vulnerable to being fired, getting their business shut down, whatever. And I think it's because we're looking at it the wrong way. So let's take an example. So if you think about what comes after Zoom, right? I don't know. You don't know. It could be holograms, it could be touchable screens, it could be virtual reality headsets, it could be a thousand things. And I don't know, but if I'm Zoom or Cisco or a company that really needs to have a presence in whatever telepresence becomes, I want to have options and I want to take out options. Now, the critical thing here is the holograph people, the movable screen people, the projectile people, they all have to feel that they're part of team post Zoom. And so if any one of them succeed, all of them succeed. And that's where I think corporations get it really wrong. They look at individual projects as the unit of analysis when they really need to look at, call it more of a program or a platform where you're going after something that's very substantial. The other thing I think that people don't do well enough is they don't separate out the learning that happens in a program from the cost of the learning, right? And a disproportion I often talk about is with ventures. The cost of failing matters infinitely more than the rate of failing. The reverse is true in the core business. High failure rates in your core business, that's terrible. Look at what's happening to Boeing right now. It's a disaster. So you don't want that. But in a new business, it's the opposite, right? If I have 1,000 failures, but each one costs me a dime, I don't care. I can try a lot of stuff. So it's a different metric that you need to be pushing. The other thing I highly recommend is something I call a contract for intelligent failure, which is you sit down with your hypos or your proven leaders and you say, okay, I want you to do this thing, this venture, but here's the rules, right? And if you live with these rules, we won't call it a failure. We'll call it an experiment. So you're testing a clearly developed hypothesis. The results are conclusive. So if it doesn't work out, we know why. You did it quickly. You did it inexpensively. You did it in a situation which involved genuine uncertainty. And you have mechanisms for now spreading the learning to other people. And if you live with those rules, we won't consider it a failure. So let me tell another story, which I think brings this to life. I was working with a bank called Vero Bank. Well, they were Vero Money, now they're Vero Bank. And it's a branchless bank which sells stuff to income secure, but cash flow challenged young people. And so it's all branchless. And the whole thing's intermediated by this AI-empowered chatbot called Val. And very early in the design process, the question came up, well, what sort of personality should Val have? And about half the group thought Val should be very conversational. Oh, hey, dude, tough weekend, huh? Hey, don't worry, got your back. Emoji, very casual, very chatty. And the other half of the team was not on board with this. They said, no, we're a bank. This is your life savings. You want to be treated very respectfully like a grown-up. Now, the way this usually gets resolved in companies is the most important person in the room, or the highest paid, or the loudest, makes a decision, and we all go charging down that direction. And instead, if you're doing this in an entrepreneurial way, you say, well, what's the cheapest way we could test these two hypotheses? And so what we did was we got two interns. Each intern had a role to play. They acted as though they were the chatbot. We had some wireframes programmed up. We lured members of our target segment into the conference room with promises of free pizza. And we let them play with the different interfaces given the scenarios that we'd outlined. And it turns out they hated the hey dude guy. The Mr. Robertson people, the more formal people, were right. Because when it comes to your, hey, dude, is fine for Venmo and it's fine for WeChat or whatever. But when it comes to my life savings and my security, I really want to know someone, there's a grown up in charge. Now, if you look at it through the wrong lens, the hey, dude people failed. They were not correct. Their prediction was not what was borne out. But I would argue, no, of course not. It was a perfectly reasonable hypothesis. If you look at Venmo, it's exactly that way. Went out to buy the foods that are whole. Hey, you know, emoji, emoji. So I just think the way that we frame these things. So what often happens is we bring the assumptions of an established business where you know you can predict. You there is order you can make sense of into a new business where you actually don't.
Love it. I love it, Rita. And speaking of failure, I often think about this. You talk about that moment of when a failure happens, the whole organization takes a breath and waits for your reaction. And I often think about when your child is learning to cycle a bike and they fall. And you know that moment when the kid looks at you and they fall and they look up? I was always the dad that would go, you're fine, come on, you're okay. And I think if I didn't, the kid would burst out crying. If he went, oh, you poor thing, go over to the car. And I often think about that moment from a leadership perspective. And you mentioned this, and you mentioned that there's usually three great ways that an entrepreneur leader deals with this, deals with failure: a constructive postmortem, recouping, and spotting entrapment. Three great tools to use.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So spotting entrapment is the why are we still doing this question, right? Which is we're putting in more and more money, but we're not getting anything back. We're losing talent that we'd like to keep. People are not reporting increased satisfaction or delight. So there's that permission to even ask the difficult to ask questions. So I think that's one. Recoupment is an interesting one because what people often don't think about enough is, okay, so something didn't work out. How do we make people whole? Like if you've disappointed a customer or you've let an employee down or you've made a mistake with an alliance partner, what could you do to make it right? And do it with an open heart and be genuine about it. And if you approach it that way, chances are you're going to build more trust, you'll build more loyalty, and they'll be willing to try something new with you again. If you just ignore that it was a problem for them, that causes the opposite, right? They're going to be more distrustful. They're unlikely to want to work with you again. And then figuring out your exit strategy, right, is how do I now go from here to where I need to be in a new way?
Rita, I would love you to tell us a little bit about the new book. So just for those looking at behind me here, look, there's a perfect kind of symmetry here. There's three of Rita's books over my left shoulder there. And then there's two and there's a blank space. And the blank space is there on purpose. That's for Rita's new book. Rita's going to tell us about that in a moment. I picked a quote that I absolutely love from the book and one that every entrepreneur leader can aim for. And I wanted to share that with an audience as always to also celebrate your writing as well. And I loved this book. You wrote here, "You will have succeeded when everyone in the organization takes it for granted that business success is about a continual search for new opportunities and a continual letting go of less productive activities. You will have succeeded when everyone feels that he or she has not only the right but the obligation to seek out new opportunities and to make them happen. You will have succeeded when the hallways buzz with energy, when people come to work excited, and when they are proud to be associated with your dynamic organization. And of course, you will have succeeded when the value you create within your organization translates into stakeholder wealth." Beautiful. Encapsulates the aim of the book and the aim of every leader inside an organization. Rita, over to you to give us your final word on your new book, that blank space there that's coming soon.
Well, the book's in the process of being written, so that's emerging yet. But the core thesis is that technologies today are getting good enough that they can actually substitute for what the best of management has done historically. Which is allow teams to look at leading indicators, to self-manage, to make decisions very quickly at the edges of the organization, to experiment more rapidly, and to learn much more quickly. And those things are now becoming real. And I think against a backdrop in which some vast number of people report feeling disengaged at work, they don't feel their capabilities are being drawn upon, they feel that they're just cogs in some kind of giant, horrible machine, I think what we're looking at is the real potential for human flourishing in the workplace. And I think now we've got technologies that can architect that so that you can architect out the toxic managers and the bad bosses and the people who are not willing to lead in a way that is collaborative and cooperative. And a couple of data points that I think are very interesting is even today, we tend to hire leaders on the basis of confidence. If that person's confident, they seem to have it. Let's give the reins of leadership to them. And Thomas Chamorro for Music has done some research which shows that if you map confidence onto competence, there's only about a 9% match. Meaning all that confidence is just that. It's people who are really good at projecting confidence. So what I'm thinking about the book is perhaps this is a blueprint for how we can architect organizations which are just much smarter about making those kinds of decisions than the ones that we have today.
Beautiful. Look forward to that, Rita, as well. Do you have a ballpark of when it's like that ballpark of when it's coming out?
Well, I'm hoping to deliver the manuscript to the middle of the summer. And then we're going to have to see when it hits the world. Is really 2024, something like 81 different countries are having elections. And so it's likely to be a fairly distracted year. So it may make 2024, it may be early 2025. In an ideal world, it would be the autumn of 2024, but we'll have to see.
Okay, and I'm going to leave Rita in peace. So I had intended to cover all these books. We're going to take a pause on this series on Rita's work. And as you can see, so much to cover. Market Busters was the next in line there. Absolute gem of a book as well. But we will get into that in time. And indeed, Rita's new book. Rita, I want to thank you so much for joining us and spending so much time with us. It was an absolute pleasure. But before I do, where can people find out more about you, ThoughtSparks, Valise, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, so RitaMcGrath.com is a great place to start. I also have a sister company which has produced software that we hope will be helpful to people trying to do these innovation programs. It's called Spark Hub. And the Valise website is valize.com. And if you just click on manage, you'll find a live demo and other assets that you can look at. And I have a regular publication that I put out called Thought Sparks, designed to spark your thinking. And you can subscribe on LinkedIn, on Substack, on Medium. And of course, I post articles on my website as well. So lots of different places to encounter me. I'm pretty easy to reach. My email's right on the Columbia Business School website. So feel free to reach out if you have questions.
Author of The Entrepreneurial Mindset, Rita McGrath, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.